You are listening to a Bible talk recorded at the 1984 Western Christadelphian Bible School at Manuka. This is the first class in a series given by Brother Doug Shrimpton on the subject, The Sermon on the Mount.
Thank you very much and good morning to you all. This is the third time that my wife and I have been down here. We always find it exceedingly pleasant and very enjoyable. With possibly one exception, I think at some time or another, all of you have been to school or through the learning institutions. Somewhere or another, some of you may be just a minimum amount and others may be to the extent, the full extent of what is provided in our institutions of learning. Whether that makes any real difference to you or not depends entirely upon how that which you learn affects your nature, affects the things you do, the way you look at life, and ultimately, of course, as to whether you are accepted in the eyes of the ultimate examiner, which is, of course, God and Christ. Now, when we start with the Sermon on the Mount, the first words that we read there is, and Christ, seeing the multitudes, he went up into a mountain, and when he was set, his disciples came unto him, and he opened his mouth and taught them, saying. So in this particular case, the professor is Christ, not me. The one who is teaching is our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. Now, what we're going to do, we're going to accept that principle, but we're going to have to look, first of all, at one other little qualification that Jesus gives us. And he gives that to us in the 18th chapter of Matthew. At that particular point, the disciples, those that he was teaching in the Sermon on the Mount, came round him and they were very much concerned. Now, who is going to be greatest in the kingdom? I would think it's a legitimate question, a legitimate interest for those people who had been with Christ, who had at this point seen some of his miracles, who had listened to his parables, who had been with him when he taught the sermon. And they came to him and they said, who will be greatest? Now, Christ didn't say, well, according to the way I've observed you while you've been with me, you are a good administrator, therefore you will be in charge of this. According to this one, you have shown that you are able to look after those people who need help, therefore that will be your side of the business. He didn't do that at all. He did a simple little thing. He called a little child unto him, and he set him in the midst of them. Here he is. Just a little child. Now, the word that's used there is a little child. It's the word that's used for a child almost freshly weaned up to possibly a child of about that size. And he says to them, he says to the disciples, the people who were concerned as to what would be their position in the kingdom, he says, unless ye be converted and become as this little child. And he says something which I feel is very, very serious. He says, unless that is so, you cannot enter into the kingdom. Now, I would feel that there's no question about the conversion of this little child. Whether he has or has not been converted, there is a question about whether we've been converted. But surely the lesson is something we have to learn. Verily I say unto you, except ye be converted. Now, did his disciples really need converting at that point? Unless you do, you cannot enter into the kingdom of heaven. Now, I'll read you just to Now, I do hope that you will check me up on these issues. I don't want any of you to say, well, Brother Shrimpton said it, and therefore I've written it in my Bible, and that is it. Please don't do that. Please examine it for yourself. And if I'm not right, as one very eminent man wrote, he said, if you don't agree with me, come and tell me. I will look at what you have to say. And if you're right, I shall be glad to accept your opinion. But Christ goes on. He says, whoever will humble himself, therefore, and become... Now, this is from the Amplified Bible. And the Amplified Bible is a Bible which examines the words and gives you, in English, what the original Greek words would appear to mean had they been spoken in Greek and we understood Greek as we would have understood them. And this is what the Amplified Bible says. Whoever will humble himself, therefore, and become trusting, lowly, loving, forgiving, as this little child, is greatest in the kingdom of heaven. Now, you had something of that in your first class this morning. Whoever will humble himself, therefore, and whoever receives and accepts and welcomes one little child like this for my sake and in my name receives and accepts and welcomes me. So now we'll start with the sermon proper, which of course is the first verse of the fifth chapter of Matthew. But we're not going to start at that and just go way through verse by verse. I wonder if we can to try and understand just what our professor is trying to teach us and the point from which he starts and the premise on which he finishes. And of course the Sermon on the Mount finishes the end of chapter 7. We're not going right to the end at the moment. Verse 21 of the 7th chapter, not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, shall enter the kingdom of heaven, but he who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. I'm reading from the Authorized, from the Revised Standard Version. On that day many will say to me, but Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name and cast out demons in your name and do many mighty works in your name? And then will I declare unto them, I never knew you. Depart from me, you evildoers. Then he gives us that little parable, one I think the whole world is familiar with. Everyone who hears these words of mine and does them will be like a wise man who built his house upon a rock. The rain fell, the wind, the floods came, the winds blew and beat upon that house. But it did not fall because it had been founded on the rock. And everyone who hears these words of mine and does not do them will be like a foolish man who built his house upon the sand. The rain fell, the floods came, the winds blew and beat upon that house, and it fell, and great was the fall of it. So that is the beginning. His disciples come unto him. He opens his mouth and he teaches them. And then he says, as a result of my teaching, you will either build your house upon a rock. Remember those other little words that I read just a few minutes ago. Whoever hears these words of mine and does them. A teaching is useless unless it has the effect of bringing action as a result of that teaching. Great was the fall of that house. And then a little footnote, which is the last verse of all. And when Jesus finished these sayings, the crowds were astonished at his teaching. For he taught them as one that had authority and not as the scribes. Now, I have bought a book some many years ago. It's a book by a man named Davis, a highly qualified man in the normal sense of the word, and particularly in the scriptural and theological form. And he wrote a book which he calls The Introduction to the Sermon on the Mount. There's 500 pages of closely typed material that he considers to be what we have to go through to understand the Sermon on the Mount. He examines the way the scribes would see it. He examines the way the Pharisees would see it. He examines the ways the Sadducees would see it. He looks at the way that it would affect the Romans, the Greeks, and the ordinary man in the street, the Jew, the peasant. And he does a very, very thorough job. Now, I'm not going to give you 500 pages of that. I couldn't remember it even if I wanted to. But it does show you that there are so many people there listening to that sermon or listening subsequently to that sermon that it isn't a simple issue. Now, we can be, if we will, we don't have to make a big effort, but if we will, we can be like, as Christ says, a little child and be converted. We have to start all over again. And our teacher is the Savior of mankind. Seeing the multitudes, he went up into the mountain. When he was set, his disciples came unto him. He opened his mouth and taught them, saying, Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. The first time I became conscious of that, I found it rather perplexing and something of a shock, because I think most of us would feel that to be poor in spirit is to not be a follower of Christ. And that unless we had a certain amount of spirit, and even if we could have a richness of spirit, then we would be a follower of Christ, and therefore a candidate for the kingdom of heaven. And yet Christ tells us right away, now we're going right back to the kindergarten stage. We're becoming as the little child, as Jonathan Sleeper there, and we are trusting. We are lowly, and we are open to be instructed. So what does it mean, then, to be poor in spirit? Surely it doesn't mean that we have no religious spirit at all. Surely it can't mean that we just have no compatibility with Christ or his teaching. The word blessed, in Greek it is makarios, the same word that a few years ago when the Bishop Makarios on the island of Cyprus, and that was the very same word, the same Greek word. Blessed is a way to translate it. Other versions translate it as happy. At one time, I used to say, much like we had that little story this morning in the first stage, I was quite certain that it meant spiritually prosperous. I'm not so sure of that now, but it certainly means something in that region to be blessed in the ways of Christ or in the teaching of Christ must be prosperous in a certain way. But it certainly means happy. It certainly means that we are content. It certainly means that we have found something worthwhile. So we have found something worthwhile when we are poor in spirit, not when we are rich in spirit. And that would seem to be a negation of what we would normally accept. And that is one of the main reasons, or that is the main reason, why I asked Brother Ted and Dolores whether I could borrow Jonathan. Because what it meant, and what this means here, the poor in spirit doesn't mean to say that you have no regard for Christ or his teaching. What it means is that you are not arrogant in that knowledge. And as far as I'm able to dig out, and I have quite a collection of lexicons and dictionaries, as far as I'm able to dig out, that is what it means to be reduced in our arrogance, in our religion. Now, if we can understand that, I don't wish to alter the words, I don't wish to alter the translation. What we do have to remember is that this was written in Greek, but in all probability was conceived in Hebrew. because while there are some opinions that Christ might have spoken Greek, I'm quite sure that he would think and act, and that his main concern would be his own language, which was essentially the language of the common people, Aramaic. But as Christ also spoke classical Hebrew, he could not have read the scroll of Isaiah if he did not speak classical Hebrew. So we do tend to think and conceive our thoughts in our own particular language. And the Sermon on the Mount was conceived in classical Hebrew. Was one little point, a little loop road off the main theme for that. We've already had Psalms quoted this morning. We already had Psalm 37 quoted. And Psalm 37 I'm going to quote again now. Because when you look down to the third of those Beatitudes, blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Now if you turn over in your book of Psalms to Psalm 37, and you look at Psalm 37 and verse 11, and if you like to read it, I won't read it for you, I'll recite it for you. I can actually read it for you from the New Testament. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. And I hope before the week is over that I'll be able to show you that all of those Beatitudes are actually quotes from the first book of Psalms. Therefore, I feel justified in going also to the first book of Psalms for a little more understanding of this first one. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And you'll find that one too, also in the book of Psalms. But I think possibly at this moment, we'll leave that and we'll go into these details a little more thoroughly a little later in the week. What I want to do at this moment, if we possibly can, on this particular class, is to establish the very principle that unless we are willing to be converted as the little child, we shall not enter into the kingdom of heaven. Now, there are four exclusive clauses in our Bible. You'll all be very familiar with the first two that come from the book of John. Unless ye be born of water and of the Spirit, ye shall in no wise enter into the kingdom of heaven. Now, many of you here, I'm sure, have been baptized. Whether we have achieved a spiritual rebirth, I do not know. I do not know whether I have ever achieved a spiritual rebirth. But there are those two clauses. There are two others. One of those is the one we've just had, to become as a little child. And the other one is, unless your righteousness, which we shall have in the sermon, unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees, you shall in no wise enter into the kingdom. So we have to learn, and we have to accept the master, the professor, as our teacher. And when we come to the end of the sermon, we have to be able to say, to know or to feel that we are either building or have built our house upon a rock, or we have been made to realize that we have built it upon the sand. So if we can understand that we should be happy in the start of our journey towards the kingdom, if we can become poor in spirit. Not without spirit, but just as a little child. They have loads of spirit, goodness knows. You can't keep them down half the time. They bubble up and they run around and they have more energy than I can produce in a month. But it doesn't mean quite that. It means that they are lowly, humble, forgiving, amenable to teaching. And that is what this first one means. And that is what we must become. Now, it doesn't mean to me as a teacher. It means to Christ as the teacher. Blessed are those who mourn, he continues. So if we have found, if we can find in this first one, and let's just think of it as we go through the week, that we're going through grade school. And right at the moment, we've just enrolled in kindergarten, or grade one if you like. We're just starting school. We have found that we can sit here and realize that we don't know it all. However much we know, there's still far more to learn than ever we've learned up to this point. And in saying these things, I'm not criticizing anybody. I don't think or hope anyone think that I'm doing that. I don't know many of you, and those that I do know, I doubt whether I know more than just a little. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Does that one puzzle anybody? I didn't find either of these two easy to comprehend. Is it blessed to go around with tears running down your face? Is it blessed to go around spreading sorrow wherever we go? Is that what that means? Again, we have to have a little more careful look at the words. Look at a little more detail as to what could be meant. Because, as I already hinted and didn't say too much about, if the sermon was conceived in the Hebrew language and then recorded in Greek and then translated into English, we have three separate and distinct languages to go through. Now, Hebrew is the language of religion. Greek is the language of philosophy. And English is a language which will cover just about anything under the sun and nothing 100% thoroughly. So we do have that. And another book I have at home, a book that I read every now and again, was written, strangely enough, by a Catholic. But he says, behind every thought in the New Testament, there is a Hebrew thought from the Old Testament. So when we have this, blessed are those, and again we get this same contradiction, because how can one be blessed in mourning if a better understanding of the word blessed is happy? We get two ideas which are in head-on collision. We cannot be happy and sorrowful at the same time. So what does it mean? I think the word behind this idea of mourning is a fairly common Hebrew word. It's called hesed. As we would spell it C-H-E-S-E-D. It's only three consonants in the Hebrew. And it means mercy. It is translated loving kindness. It is translated concern. It's translated compassion. Now, if that is the Hebraic thought behind this expression in the Greek language translated into English, then we can say, happy are those who have the capacity for compassion and for compassionate concern. And our compassion and our concern needn't get us down, because we're told that those people who have that are the very people who will be comforted. Blessed are the meek. Do we think, do we believe, do we accept that we are meek? Is it a thought? Is it something that we have really stop and think, now, am I meek? We're told that Moses was the meekest man that ever lived, and yet Moses led an army. If you read Josephus, you'll find it's recorded in there that before Moses led the children of Israel into the wilderness, Moses led an expedition. He led the whole of the Egyptian army down into Ethiopia, and it was a successful expedition. He was a general in the Egyptian army. And yet, he was a meek man. He was a man who had to stand before a rebellious people on a number of occasions, and we're still told he was the meekest man that ever lived. Is it mixed up? Or are we mixed up if we can't understand it in the way the Bible would have us understand it. We have to go back again to words. We had something of this again in the first session this morning. Many of the Hebrew words, in fact, I think most of the Hebrew words, are onomatopoetic or they are expressive. The Hebrew word for fear is yah. Now, it's a sort of sound that you make without bothering to think when you're startled, when you're scared, when something frightens you. It's a sort of sound that jumps out of you. You saw on the screen there this morning another Hebrew word, shub. Just think of that one, too. That is much the same thing. Something you hate, something you detest. It's the sort of sound that you make without thinking about a word, shub. It's just like that. And the other one, the word for a gentle breeze, onomatopoetic. The same with the one which is used for spirit, nefesh. It's onomatopoetic. It describes the very feeling. The word meek in Hebrew is anav. And if you go into your dictionaries, now when you go to your dictionaries, please don't stop at Young's, because if you read Young's, you'll find that it tells you right at the beginning that this is not intended to be an exposition of Hebrew and Greek words. All it is a concordance. And it just tells you which particular Greek word is equated to which particular English word. But Young does not claim to be an expositor of Hebrew and Greek. And when you look at the word anav and go back to your Hebrew dictionaries and your lexicons, you'll find that it is the word that is used for respond, to answer. If I talk to you, and then you answer me, you anav or you anava. That is the word that is used, and that is the word that's translated meek. So it isn't a matter of being bent over, of doing, if any of you know Dickens, like Uriah Heep, the humble servant, he says, I am your humble servant. And yet that man was so crafty that eventually he succeeded in getting rid of his lawyer employer and taking over the business. And yet he always said, I am your humble servant. There was no humility in Uriah Heep. Humility and meekness are portrayed again in the Old Testament by the same word, anav, to respond. And that was why Moses was the meekest man that ever lived. He was the man who responded to God and to God's commands. He made a few mistakes, but he responded. When he was told to go and lead his people out of Egypt, he went. When he was told to lead them through the wilderness, I would have very much hesitated to have set out on that journey as a follower, let alone as a leader, to take those people, men, women, children, knowing that much of the country you were taking them through, and Moses did know, because being a general, you had to know those things before you started off on an expedition. Moses knew that it wouldn't be easy, but God said, do it. And Moses was meek. He responded. It is much the same as we had in that first one. Blessed are the poor in spirit. It was not Moses' own spirit, which I think would have been possibly our response. I don't want to do this. This is a hard task. It is. Thy will be done, as Christ said later in the gospel. And Moses undertook or responded to the command that that's what he was to do. To be meek is not to be weak. To be meek is to be strong, but in a certain direction. Strong in response to the commands of Christ, of God through Christ. So let's have a look at those three and see if they do constitute sort of stepping stones on the way up. Blessed are the poor in spirit, those who are willing to be converted, who are willing to forget all that we think we know up to this point, and say to our professor, Jesus Christ, yes, teach me. I'm willing to learn. Let's go beyond that and say, teach me. I want to learn. Let's go beyond that and say, teach me. I'm determined to learn. If we can then grasp the idea that compassionate concern is an essential part of Christ's teaching, and then if we can come to this one, that with those two attributes, ready to be taught, having the capacity for compassion on those people round about us, and then we can achieve this meekness, this more than a readiness, an ardent desire to respond to the teachings of the professor. But what are we asked to direct our thoughts to? I hope you'll find with me, I don't know whether I should say that, I don't want to direct and influence your thinking, so let me express it in a different way. The way I find it is this, that if we can get down to that start, a new beginning, if we can get down to the point at which we are teachable, once again, to be converted, to turn again, remember Peter. Peter had been with Christ quite a long time. And Christ turns to Peter and he says, when you are converted, and I would have thought when Christ said that to Peter that Peter would long since been converted, but apparently he had not. But what we required is this. If we can come to this point through those through first three Beatitudes, he says, blessed are those who hunger and thirst after righteousness. Have those first three brought us to that point? Do we now feel that what we must do, what we have to do, what must be the sum total of our desire is to hunger and thirst after righteousness? For those who do, we're told, shall be satisfied. Now, righteousness is one of the most peculiar words in the whole of the English language. Almost every other word we can qualify, but we can't qualify righteousness. Righteousness is either righteousness or it is not. We cannot be 25% righteous. We cannot be half righteous or even 5% righteous or even 95% righteous. We are either righteous or we're unrighteous. Some few years ago in one of our local schools, one of the teachers put up a questionnaire for the children as to which the children thought was the most worthy word in the whole of the English language. And there was all sorts of ideas came from the children. They were not elderly children, they were young children. And one child only put up this idea of righteousness. And when the class had considered all the ideas that were put forth, this particular class decided that that was, indeed, the one word of real value. If we can come then through that period of saying we're going to start all over again, we're going to forget all that we have known up to now, and we're going to make a determined effort to relearn from the professor. If we can find that ability for compassionate concern, if we can find meekness that is response, then we can start hungering and thirsting after righteousness. But then, what is righteousness? If we're going to hunger and thirst after a thing, surely we must have some sort of idea of what it is we're hungering and thirsting for. Do we have a hazy idea of what is righteous or what is not? I suppose we have to jump immediately again back to the Old Testament, and we're told there that God is a God of righteousness. Christ tells us, and I know the word is different, but the idea is still the same, and it still comes from the same basic idea and words in the Old Testament, when the young man goes to Christ and calls him good. And Christ says, "Why callest thou me good? There is none good but one, and that is God." And the same idea there, the same root idea is, there is only one who is truly righteous. And at Christ's baptism too, he said, "Thus it becometh us to fulfill all righteousness." But what is righteousness? We can be right about so many things. Again, the little story you had a little while ago about the man who was always right about everything until he suddenly admitted he was wrong about something and then find out that he was right about that anyway. What is righteousness? Do we have to put it in a certain pocket? Do we have to put it in a little enclave and say, this is righteous within these walls, this is righteous within the confines of these ideas, within the confines of these qualifications? Or can we say of something, there is righteousness? Yes, we need to think about it, don't we? Well, I do. I shouldn't say you do. I don't know whether you do or not. Your minds may be a lot quicker than mine in grasping these things. But what is righteousness? Now, at this point, we can either put our own definitions on it, or we can say to the professor, at this point, I don't really follow that, but carry on. I'll try and learn. So let us take that attitude. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. That's again from that same root, hesed. Various ways it's used, mercy, compassion. Blessed are those who have compassion. Now, are we getting a repeat in different ways of the first three? Are we merciful? Have we thought back? Can we think back about our actions over the last week and have all our responses, all our meekness, have they been merciful? I think the next phrase can be, religion, you know, is a serious business. And the next phrase can be quite chastising. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. Just suppose Christ comes back. Suppose Christ was standing over there and looking over the assembly here. Is there one here that wouldn't want mercy? Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. So if we expect Christ to be merciful to us, then we must be merciful to others. These things are so fundamental. In our kindergarten class, in our grade 1, They're the sort of things that we have to learn. We must know, we must grasp, we must digest them. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Such a simple little phrase, so easy to read over, it slips out so conveniently, and it's gone. But must it be that way? Are we right if we do it that way? Blessed are the pure in heart. I don't know. I don't know what it is to be pure in heart. I can have some ideas. I can have some ideals that I can strive for. But whether I truly understand it, I have doubts. But when Christ stands before us to select those who are going into the kingdom, he says, unless you have achieved purity of heart, you will not see God. In other words, it's another one which excludes us from the kingdom. Just the same as the mercy one. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. And unless we obtain mercy, we certainly shall not be in the kingdom. Blessed are the peacemakers. The peacemakers shall be called the sons of God. I would feel there's a definite relationship between the peacemaker and those who mourn. To feel sorry for people who are the victims of unhappiness. To feel sorry for the people who in some way suffer, and possibly through our own actions, from the way we live, from the things we do. Well, those people who are peacemakers, we are told, shall be called the sons of God. So just about every one of these beatitudes up to this point are exclusive. We either have them, at least in some measure. We either have them at least because we desire them, but may not have achieved them. But at least we know that they are necessary. And then we have a chance of being in the kingdom. Or if we choose to ignore them, it would appear we don't have a chance of being in the kingdom at all. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Another one, too, that we can so easily veneer our own ideas onto. It's something that we can even encourage. We can go around shouting that we are Christian, that we believe in the Bible, and we can virtually invite people to be antagonistic. And we can then adopt the attitude, I am being persecuted for righteousness' sake, therefore I am worthy. But that is not what this verse means at all. Again, from the first little class this morning, it was pointed out that we can use words to convey meaning and to alter the way our audience grasps what we're saying. As one simple little illustration, just three words, I can say, well, I was walking, in which case it's a straightforward little phrase, I was walking. Or else I can say, I was walking. That then picks me out, you're not walking, I am walking. Or I can say, I was walking, in which case it's in the past tense. I'm not doing it now, but I was walking. Or I can say, I was walking, which means now that I'm emphasizing the idea of walking as distinct from running or standing still. And the same applies to so many of these things. It not only depends upon the words, it depends upon the way the words go into us and the way the words come out of us. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake. Now, something I didn't mention when we were looking at righteousness before, but something that just has to be mentioned, and I'm sure is fundamental to our grasp. Righteousness is not my prerogative, or yours, or anybody else's. Righteousness is an all-pervading thing. If we hunger and thirst after righteousness, I'm not hungering and thirsting after righteousness. In other words, that all you people here shall be righteous to me. I have to be righteous to you. Righteousness is something like a blanket. It covers everything or nothing. And when we are persecuted for righteousness' sake, we are persecuted by those who are not righteous, but not because we have ignored that first commandment. Blessed are the poor in spirit. We've gone about inviting people to persecute us. But where we are persecuted because we are righteous, as many have been done in the past, and any of those who have read Brother Alan Ayer's book will know that there is a long history of people who were persecuted for righteousness' sake. But they didn't go about inviting persecution. They stood up for what they believed. They were persecuted. And we're told that those people, theirs is the kingdom of heaven. So our professor doesn't leave us in any doubt at all, does he? He says, if you are as little children, if you are striving for, heading for the kingdom, then he puts these phrases in time and time again. Poor in spirit, theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Merciful, they shall obtain mercy. The pure in heart shall see God. Peacemakers, called the sons of God. Persecuted for righteousness' sake, theirs is the kingdom of heaven. I think verse 11 helps to explain a little bit of what I'm saying. Blessed are you when men revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you, falsely, not accurately, not truly, when you are accused falsely of being righteous. This is hypocrisy. It is the one thing that Christ condemned in the scribes and Pharisees. As he says in the 23rd chapter of Matthew, O you scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites. And he condemns them as whited sepulchres full of dead men's bones. He condemns them as vipers. I would hate to have been there and had Christ say things like that to my face. Blessed are you when men shall revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you, falsely, on my account. Then he says, rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven, for so persecuted the prophets which were before you. Then he says, now you are the salt of the earth. But if the salt has lost its taste, this is the Revised Standard, how shall its saltness be restored? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trodden underfoot of men. Now for this one, we have to go way back into Leviticus, the 2nd chapter and the 13th verse. And at that one, we're told that you must bring salt with your oblation. I have brought a couple of books with me that some of you might like to look at. They're called the Commandments. And it lists the whole of the negative commandments and the whole of the positive commandments. And they point out on this particular commandment here to bringing of salt, the salt of the oblation, that there is both a negative and a positive quote. Incidentally, how much time is that? Is that end now? That's finished. Okay, thank you. Just this last little bit then. They're told that they shall bring their sacrifice with the salt of oblation. That makes it a positive command. But then it also repeats in the same verse, but you shall not bring your oblation without salt. And so there is both a positive and a negative to that. So at this point, we'll leave that one and we'll start there tomorrow. And I hope we'll feel that we can move up into grade 2. Thank you.